Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you have come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Andrew Rome, and I am serving as today's worship associate. I am joined by Mary Stevenson, the executive director of COAR, the community of Oscar A. Romero, an organization which works in El Salvador, running a school, foster care facility, and clinic, serving the entire impoverished community of Zaragoza. The outreach office for COAR has been in the Catholic Diocese of Cleveland, with over 6,000 supporters from throughout North America. COAR's work continues today, responding to the crisis of gang violence and unaccompanied minors at the U.S.-Mexican border. Today, we will hear about COAR's work as an example of the Catholic tradition of social justice, as well as a practical and compassionate response to crisis and poverty. Announcing our new director. An announcement from Mary Leeson.
It is my pleasure to introduce to you our new interim director of religious education, Karen Labracco. Karen is a credentialed religious professional. She has 11 years experience as a DRE, and she has served as Lifespan Faith Development Consultant for 6 years for the St. Lawrence and Ohio Meadville District. Now, as an interim person, an interim is usually hired after a beloved staff member who has served the congregation for a long time, like Karen Lapidus, leaves. So an interim is only here for a one-year position, and she is tasked with not only making sure the RE program runs smoothly, but she'll also help us kind of gain perspective of our own unique RE history and culture and determine how we can grow to meet the needs of our future, which is especially timely for us as we enter this building phase and are contemplating what kinds of spaces and programming we should plan for. Now, since Karen lives in Brockport, New York, and she's only here 20 hours a week for a year, we have a rather unique arrangement. She will be living in Kent approximately 10 or 11 days with Randy and Renee Rahutsky, thanks to them. And so she will be here two consecutive Sundays and then the week in between to meet with staff and committee meetings, that type of thing. So even though we will only see her two Sundays a month, she will be working from home the rest of the time, and make no mistake, the work will be done. But in recognition of only 20 hours a week, our RE assistant, Colleen Taylor, will expand in her role and move from 5 hours a week up to 12 hours a week. So she will have a much bigger presence in the program as well. So please join me in welcoming Karen Labracco.
Our chalice lighting today was written by Dale Hudson. This is a house of reflection and contemplation, of joy and sorrow, friendship, sharing, and laughter. We light this chalice in remembrance of what we have been and in hope of what we may become. Amanda, my spouse, and I have been together for 14 wonderful years. Now, for the first few years, we pursued our separate religious practices. I was a Roman Catholic college student, figuring out how to make my faith work after moving away from my community. Amanda was unchurched. I was tolerant, but not especially open-minded. However, I really liked her. So I spent some years learning about Amanda's beliefs and took classes in world religions. My beliefs expanded and evolved and became more appreciative of difference. And Amanda attended church with me often, but our experiences of the Catholic Mass were very different. Well, I would hear the priest say something about the sanctity of life and understand it as the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Amanda would hear it as anti-abortion politics. I could only see the good in the service, and Amanda could only see the problems. But she kept trying to make it work for 7 years, God bless her. And then as we moved around the country, we tried to find a church that worked for both of us. We tried out Protestant churches and ended up here, and found a church whose social justice work echoed the Catholic social teaching I grew up on. The Unitarian Universalist principles of equity and compassion, of peace and liberty, of care for our interdependent web of existence, all these and more continue to remind me of some of the best parts of Catholicism. In no way do I mean to ignore the problems of the Catholic Church, which I know have hurt members of this congregation through exclusion, condemnation, or otherwise. Those problems are real, and Catholicism must continue its slow evolution away from human prejudices and failings. But its collected wisdom of 2,000 years of prophetic men and women, with their direct experiences of transcending mystery and wonder, call us to respond to God's love and inspire our ethical and spiritual lives. All of these have a place in the sources of both Unitarian Universalism and Catholicism. Amanda and I are happy to find our spiritual home here, knowing our beliefs are included in the life of this church, even when not shared by all our members. I hope this can be a service where exploring another faith can build our mutual respect. I hope finding common ground can be healing for those of us estranged from the religion of our youth. I continue my journey, drawing on the history and wisdom of Catholicism and Unitarian Universalism, working to see in each both the best parts and the opportunities to grow. Come, let us journey together. The current Roman Catholic leader, Pope Francis, published an encyclical or formal teaching on this past June 18th entitled Laudato Si, on care for our common home. He calls for greater care for the earth as a way to care for the poor and oppressed, and ends with this prayer. All-powerful God, you are present in the whole universe and in the smallest of your creatures. You embrace with your tenderness all that exists. Pour out upon us the power of your love, that we may protect life and beauty. Fill us with peace, that we may live as brothers and sisters, harming no one. O God of the poor, help us to rescue the abandoned and forgotten of this earth, so precious in your eyes. Bring healing to our lives, that we may protect the world and not prey on it, that we may sow beauty, not pollution and destruction. Touch the hearts of those who look only for gain at the expense of the poor and the earth. Teach us to discover the worth of each thing, to be filled with awe and contemplation, to recognize that we are profoundly united with every creature as we journey toward your infinite light. We thank you for being with us each day. Encourage us, we pray, in our struggle for justice, love, and peace. Amen. This reading is from the book Compassion, a Reflection on the Christian Life by Henry Nguyen, Donald McNeil, and Douglas Morrison, who were all academic Catholic priests living in Washington, D.C. The book was published in 1982, but I first read it 4 years ago as part of a year-long course on Catholic social teaching. Their reflections on how to live compassionately remind me of how Catholic beliefs inspire action and encourage me to greater patience and humility. Our actions, like our prayers, must be a manifestation of God's compassionate presence in the midst of our world. Patient actions are actions through which the healing, consoling, comforting, reconciling, and unifying love of God can touch the heart of humanity. They are actions through which the fullness of time can show itself, and God's justice and peace can guide our world. Patient action is a hard discipline. Often our lives get so overburdened that it takes every bit of energy to survive the day. Then it becomes hard to value the present moment, and we can only dream about a future time and place where everything will be different. We want to move away from the present moment as quickly as possible and create a new situation in which our present pains are absent. But such impatient action prevents us from recognizing the possibilities of the moment, and thus easily leads us to an intolerant fanaticism. Action as a discipline of compassion requires the willingness to respond to the very concrete needs of the moment. Action as the way of a compassionate life is a difficult discipline precisely because we are so in need of recognition and acceptance. This need can easily drive us to conform to the expectation that we will offer something new. In a society that is so keen on new encounters, so eager for new events, so hungry for new experiences, it is difficult not to be seduced into impatient activism. Often we are hardly aware of this seduction, especially since what we are doing is so obviously good and religious. But even setting up a relief program, feeding the hungry, or assisting the sick could be more an expression of our own needs than of God's call. But let us not be too moralistic about it. We can never claim pure motives, and it is better to act with and for those who suffer than to wait until we have our own needs completely under control. However, it is important to remain critical of our own activist tendencies. When our own needs begin to dominate our actions, long-range service becomes difficult. We become exhausted, burned out, and even embittered by our own efforts. The most important resources for counteracting the constant temptation to slip into activism is the knowledge that in Christ everything has been accomplished. This knowledge should be understood not as an intellectual insight, but as an understanding in faith. As long as we continue to act as if the salvation of the world depends on us, we lack the faith by which mountains can be moved. Mary Stevenson is the executive director of the Kaur Peace Mission, the U.S. fundraising and outreach arm of the Kaur Children's Village in Zaragoza, El Salvador. Mary got interested in El Salvador in high school when one of her teachers, Sister Dorothy Queso, began working there as part of the Cleveland Diocese Latin American mission team. She was prevented from visiting in the 1980s because of the civil war in El Salvador, which included the murder of Sister Dorothy Queso and Archbishop Oscar Romero. Mary first visited Kaur in 1990 and experienced the anguish of El Salvador's civil war through the orphans at the Kaur Children's Village. Won over by Kaur, Ms. Stevenson left a business career to become executive director in 2004. Kaur Peace Mission strives to be the tangible and real expression of the gospel to promote justice, community, and peace in El Salvador through the support of effective programs in health, education, and welfare, which assist children and others not only to develop their full human potential, but also to contribute to the betterment of the world in which they live. Throughout the year, Ms. Stevenson speaks at Catholic churches throughout North America and teaches about the work Kaur is doing in El Salvador. Her education and fundraising talks are usually part of the Catholic Mass, in which she explains how Kaur's work is derived from Jesus' teaching in the Gospel reading of the day. Now, some Gospel readings are harder to connect than others, so we picked a favorite passage to incorporate into the service today. In this Gospel reading, when Jesus had a large crowd gathered to hear him speak, he taught what we now call the Beatitudes, a central tenet of Christian discipleship.
I apologize, I have a cold. For those of you listening to this, if I cough into the microphone, rip your hearing aids out. This is a reading from the Gospel of Luke. And raising his eyes towards his disciples, Jesus said, "Blessed are you who are poor, for the kingdom of God is yours. Blessed are you who are now hungry, for you will be satisfied. Blessed are you who are now weeping, for you will laugh. Blessed are you when people hate you, when they exclude and insult you, and denounce your name as evil on account of the Son of Man. Rejoice and leap for joy on that day. Behold, your reward will be great in heaven. For their ancestors treated the prophets the same way. But woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation. But woe to you who are filled now, for you will be hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, for you will grieve and weep. Woe to you when all speak well of you, for their ancestors treated the false prophets in this way. But to you who hear what I say, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you. To the person who strikes you on one cheek, offer the other one as well. And from the person who takes your cloak, do not withhold even your tunic. Give to everyone who asks of you, and from the one who takes what is yours, do not demand it back. Do to others as you would have them do to you." And these are the words of the Lord Jesus Christ, upon whom the Catholic Church bases its 2,000 years of history. And as Andrew said, it's 2,000 years. So before I talk about Kaur, I just want to make sure we have the same context. I know this is a very diverse group with all kinds of people who know a lot about Catholicism, people who might not know much at all. As Andrew said, go around the country and speak about Kaur. And even, you know, if I'm on the plane on my way somewhere, I meet people who don't know anything about the Catholic Church, and I'll say a couple of things. The Catholic Church is big, and it is organized, but it is old. And so if you take this reading, which was written probably 2,000 years ago, and I take a minute to take us through some of that 2,000 years, what is the difference between culture and religion? When does one lead the other? When does one follow the other? When does one change the other? It's those 2,000 years of history and pretty much the whole planet that give that dynamic to Catholicism. So Catholicism spans from the Roman Empire through the Dark Ages. Before that, North Africa, St. Augustine, in the 300s. 1,000 years later, Islam swept through North Africa. This is all part of the dynamic that forms the Catholic Church. What was Gaul to the Romans became France and in England. They had what they called the barbarian invasions, maybe not barbarians, but very dislocating. Certainly wars, famines from that, differences in language and cultures through hundreds of years. the plagues. Sweden in particular was hit hard by the Black Plague. They lasted for hundreds of years, these plagues, and people looking up to God and saying, how can everybody I know, my entire village, be wiped out over and over again? It undermined all their stability, all their understanding and knowledge of the world. Then certainly there's the discovery of the New World. Spain, Portugal, France, everywhere in the world, taking some form of Catholicism with them, into the Far East, into Japan, into India, and coming back onto the Catholic Church. And then in the U.S., our legacy, certainly the immigration, the massive immigrations from Europe, Germans first that were Catholic, French, Irish, Polish, Italians, all these layers have built what the Catholic Church is today. And running through it are the Gospels. The Catholic Church hopes to always come back to the Gospels, to inform how they're reacting and acting to plagues, wars, famines, immigration. One thing, another part of the context for this is, what is capitalism itself? Well, capitalism didn't exist in the Middle Ages. It was a barter economy. There's no point. And this, the Catholic Church survived those years. Then when you had the New World founded, this is where the context that's the difference between North America and Latin America comes in. I speak in high schools frequently about COAR. And so this is my, I apologize, oversimplified version of history, but for high school students who don't know anything about Latin America, I will say, what if the South had won the Civil War in North America? Can you imagine that country on the border of Ohio? I mean, just a couple hours from here, legal slavery, a plantation economy that can only be locked down with trade tariffs. This is what happened in Latin America. The Spanish and the Portuguese came. They enslaved the millions of indigenous they found. They brought over many, many more slaves than even came to North America. And they locked down crony capitalism with a commodity economy that you can only protect through tariffs. Instead of having one big civil war that broke that down, they have had a series of revolutions and rebellions for the last couple hundred years. And for those, again, like high school students, they have this vague idea that Latin America is kind of always unsettled, and that's why. Now, the most recent version of that was in the 1980s. They call them the Dirty Wars of the 1980s. Argentina went through one, which is where Pope Francis is from, and he had to navigate horrific choices, terrible waters. Thousands, millions of people did. And clearly, we are still living with the legacy of that unrest in the immigration to the United States, the border crises. So the Catholic Church, again, to take a step back and build a little bit more of the context for COAR, right now, the Catholic Church in North America has about 18,000 parishes. That's about the same size as Methodist and Baptist. And there are several thousand more, of course, in Canada. All those churches, 99%, have some kind of local outreach. They have soup kitchens. They have care of their sick, their elderly. All churches do. That is not unique to the Catholic Church. But the Catholic Church has a couple of things that layer on top of it because it is big and it is organized. There are the religious orders. So some of you may know a lot, some it might be, there are priests, there are nuns, there are brothers. This has always been true, 2,000 years of service within the church, independent of parishes. And certainly in the 1500s, the Reformation in Europe, this was the rise of the great teaching orders and the great nursing orders. I have my degree in Reformation history as a master's degree. Almost all the education we know and experience as Western Europeans comes from the great teaching orders. They set up schools all over Europe. Certainly it went into the mainstream, but that's the beginning. And it was about serving the displaced populations of the Hundred Years' War. There was nothing but war ravaging Europe for hundreds of years. And it's the religious orders that set up schools, orphanages, and places of refuge that established that in Western society. Now we take it for granted, but it came one time in one place. The same with the nursing orders. The same with orphanages. There were thousands and thousands, and then they brought it to the United States to serve those immigrant communities. Cleveland is a perfect example. Thousands and thousands of grade schools and high schools for poor, displaced immigrant communities. They taught in their own language. We are living in a time now where that is probably not needed as much. Clearly, the Catholic Church is going through, what is it going to mean to have Catholic education? What populations is it serving now, given the United States' relative stability and wealth? Well, it is serving those immigrant communities coming up from Latin America. In healthcare, half the hospitals in the United States, more than half, were Catholic hospitals. Nursing, nuns. They've almost all sold them into hospital networks. Healthcare has gone a different direction in the States. So the Catholic Church is flexible, and it has flexed through 2,000 years of service. But back to Latin America, they don't have, right now, the same economic model as the United States for education and for healthcare. They still have crony capitalism. They're still breaking away from an older type of economy. So the Catholic Church is the social safety net almost everywhere in Latin America. It is most of the schools, it's most of the healthcare, most of the orphanages. There are plenty of people who will argue, I think almost rightly, it enables those governments not to take care of their people because the Catholic Church is out there taking care of them. This discussion has happened over the course of 2,000 years in lots of countries. It's not a new discussion. You will get people arguing that in the United States. Charities that have nothing to do with religion, but charities enable governments to not take care of their own people. It is an important discussion, but it's not a new discussion. So within this churning and whirling world, as the readings that, or the selection that Andrew chose from Henry Nouwen, we have to examine our activism to find out, why are we doing it? Are we doing the right thing? You know, 2,000 years of history. As sure as we are, we're doing the right thing now. Somebody was just as sure 100 years ago, and just as sure 500 years ago, and just as sure 1,000 years ago. So that tempers us with humility, one hopes. But at the same time, to be paralyzed and wonder if you're doing the right thing in the face of suffering is ridiculous. You have to respond to suffering. And I think that's what Coar's story is. So Coar's story starts in 1964, when the Catholic Diocese of Cleveland, Ohio, which is one of the bigger dioceses in the U.S., by the way, because they got so many Irish and Italians and Germans, they took El Salvador as a mission territory. El Salvador is in Central America. It's under Mexico, kind of the elbow where it bends. Small country. This was a worldwide program in the Catholic Church where dioceses with a relative surplus of nuns and priests and active lay volunteers would help out in places where they really didn't have enough priests and nuns to serve the people. Everybody was on their own to find this exchange. The reason Cleveland picked El Salvador is because it was the most politically stable country in Latin America in 1964. So they went down, and they turned on the lights, and they swept out the dead bats, and they restored parish life. This was the thrust of this particular program. Parish life in a small town in El Salvador, where almost everybody's illiterate, where they've got this terrible history of, at worst, oppression, at best, really, they've been isolated. You know, they're a small farming community way up in the mountains. A parish is the center of their life. It gives them the institutional structure to organize themselves, know what they want to do to respond to governments, to respond to hunger, to respond to oppression. So they went down, turned on the lights, and had this idyllic experience of restoring the center of parish life in a couple of towns through the 60s. And then El Salvador's ongoing civil war percolated again in the late 70s. The Vatican, knowing that this conflict was coming, the Vatican is where the Pope lives, and so sometimes we'll just say the Vatican, meaning the group of those who make the decisions in the church about who's going to be a bishop. They knew the conflict was coming in El Salvador and wanted to keep the church as far as possible away from it. Everything in Latin America in the 80s was very conflicted. With the U.S., it was all involved in the Cold War between the United States and the communist world and Russia. And they really tried, this may surprise you, the church wanted to stay out. They did not want to be right in the middle of it. So in 1977, they had to select a new archbishop of the capital city, San Salvador, and they selected Oscar Romero. He was very well known as a scholar, but very non-controversial, if anything, a little conservative. And they thought, this is the perfect guy to just talk about God and the church and leave the politics alone. But almost immediately in 1977, when he was installed, the murders started or escalated, of priests, of nuns, and massacres in the countryside. And he said immediately, my job is to be shepherd. They call him el buen pastor, the great pastor in Latin America. My job is to defend my people, not to have some esoteric, intellectual discussion about all this. So he personally took great risks, and he did many things. There's no time to go into it. But among the things he did, one he's most famous for is on Sundays, his homilies were radio broadcast all over the country. And he would sometimes go on for hours, and he had a list, and he would read every crime that he knew had happened. And he would say, you read that this person was a communist in the newspapers. Well, I'm here to tell you he wasn't. He was just a community activist. He was just a farmer trying to get a co-op going in his town, and he was murdered for that reason. And he went on and named the truth that as he knew it everywhere. He did that for 3 years, and he knew it would get him killed. It was only a matter of time. He set up a parallel human rights office because there was no way the government would investigate itself or the police could investigate itself. There was no independent authority. So he set up a human rights office. They went in to investigate crimes. They took testimony. They took pictures. That office still exists. Another thing he did was open refugee camps. What was happening, excuse me, to cow anybody in the countryside who had, you're good, a little farmer's co-op, say, or any kind of agitation in the countryside. The army would come in, they would machine gun everybody. And the only people who survived would sometimes be too short to be shot, children flying out of this town, somebody who'd been in his fields. They would run to the next town. Well, if the army's chasing them, the next town can't give them sanctuary. They would have to keep going and going until they hit a camp that Romero set up and could put the protection of the Roman Catholic Church around that camp. It was the only entity big enough to stand against this kind of government abuse. He sprinkled a couple of camps around the country, and he asked members of the Cleveland Mission Team, so priests and nuns and lay volunteers there, to work in the camps, to kind of sprinkle themselves in. Now that's called accompaniment. You can find it in a lot of conflicted zones. If a North American, if a U.S. citizen in particular, is standing in a camp, they will think twice about going in and just machine gunning everybody there or otherwise attacking that camp. Because the United States government will still mostly come defend us. So other countries will think about it. This was certainly true in El Salvador with the U.S. involvement in that war. Well, Romero's time came in March 1980. He was murdered. He was standing at the altar in a chapel not too much bigger than this one. And he looked up, and there was a man in a Jeep, an army person dressed in fatigues, because this was the government, and shot him in the chest, blew his chest open. This was on a Monday morning at a mass where they knew journalists would be present, so they wanted to send that message. That was March 1980. The camps filled up that summer. One of the Cleveland priests in one of the camps saw a couple of kids that were just so sick and destroyed by what they'd seen, their families murdered in the countryside, running for days, drinking river water, eating garbage, just trying to find a safe place, that he couldn't leave them there. And so he brought them, because he did what any of you would do, any of us would do, brought them back to the parish he was running in Zaragoza. The town rallied around. They built bunk beds. They brought food. Women were wet nursing babies. And word got out that a North American priest would take care of and protect children, and they brought them to him by the hundreds. Then, in December 1980, as we've already said, and maybe some of you remember, there were four North American churchwomen. They were abducted, they were tortured, and then they were murdered on December 2nd, 1980. Two were Mary Knoll nuns from New York, and two were from Cleveland, from the Cleveland Mission Team. Sister Dorothy Kazel, one of my high school teachers, and I've actually brought a good friend of hers with me, Sister Sheila Marie Toby in the back, if anybody remembers those times and would like to ask Sister Sheila Marie some questions. And Jean Donovan, a laywoman, a volunteer, only 27 years old, that blew the war open. By early 1981, Father Ken had hundreds of children at this church in Zaragoza. And he wrote back to the Bishop of Cleveland, and he said, send me money, send me people. This is going to last. And our bishop had to say to him, I can't send you anyone. You could all be killed, which was quite likely at that moment. Or you could all be kicked out of the country. You need another solution. And he said this to him. He said, go find some nuns, because this is a layer of the Catholic Church that is available. And like nuns everywhere in the Catholic world, they went like this. And the kids were cleaned up. They were deloused. They built a school. They built a clinic. They built all these buildings and institutions that put a protective bubble around about 1,000 children for the next 10 years of the war. And not without cost. They were always menaced. They were always threatened. And Sister Stanislaus, was shot in the head in 1989. She survived just barely. But this was not without cost, but they did it because that's what they wanted to do with their lives. And then on the money side, the bishop said, you can't do this through the diocese. We're just too hot politically. So they formed as an independent little charity within the Diocese of Cleveland that was run by lay folks. That's what you would say in the Catholic Church, not a priest, not a nun. It's the rest of us, the laity. And it's because of that lay arm, which is so well organized in the Catholic Church, for so many charities, that COAR has been able to survive for 35 years. Because the nuns left in 2009, because nuns in the Catholic Church are declining in number very quickly, very rapidly. So this is the challenge we all have to face. So we went to the Archbishop of San Salvador and said, well, the nuns are leaving, you probably want to close COAR down. And he said, please don't leave me. So the war ended in 92, and they just went right into, though, the violence never ended. The economy didn't recover. China and India's rise, unfortunately, took what small advantage Latin America was going to have as a small manufacturing place where they were close to the States. It just kind of undermined their economies. And El Salvador is small. It is only the size of Massachusetts. And here is the shocking statistic. Of the 8 million people alive today who were born in El Salvador, 2 million of them are in the States. They have the highest immigration rate to the States by far. That's 25%, and it's the adult population, it's the parents who have left trying to find something better for their kids in the States, and they've left those kids behind with grandparents. So this is what the Archbishop said to us, please don't leave me. I mean, this is what I'm dealing with. You know what I'm dealing with. You know, don't tell me that just because you don't have nuns, you can't run this place. And we said, okay, so we're in it with him. This is part of the flexibility. So I will illustrate with a quick story, I hope, of the kind of family we take care of. I think this is just a perfect story. So a woman was diagnosed with terminal cancer, and this was late 90s, so after the war. She has 6 kids, the oldest was 12, youngest is 3, and she brought them to then the nuns at COAR, and she said, can you take care of them? Their dad won't. He's typical. He was running from town to town, trying not to be abducted as a child soldier, so no education, very unstable character. And the nun said, of course. We took the 6 kids in. About 3 weeks later, she died. Right after that, the dad showed up, and he wanted the 2 oldest boys back. And he wants them for that daily grind of living that's so hard in a poor country, selling gum on the street corners, fetching water. And it's not Catholic orphan jail, it's foster care, which is much harder to integrate those families, to try to keep very damaged and needy family members together and raise their children to be intact. So the 4 younger ones go home and visit their dad occasionally. And several years into this situation, I was down there for one of my regular visits, and I went with the 2 oldest to go visit their dad. I'm sorry, the 4 youngers to visit their dad and their brothers. When we got off the bus, the first thing the dad did was buy big bottles of soda pop because it's cheap, it's safer than the water, and the sugar will keep them from being hungry all weekend. And we walked down to their house, and it's exactly what you would expect, and probably many of you have seen. It's mud and plastic bags and sticks all waddled together. And that would almost be okay because El Salvador is a hot weather country. But there's 2 big problems. One is it melts away to nothing in the rainy season, so it's not very healthy. And the second is there is no door to lock against that crime that is ravaging Central America. When the drug gangs make a sweep through town, and they say, we want your boys to be our soldiers, or we want your daughter to be our special friend, and they do, he has no way to protect his children. This is a shack of plastic bags. All their water is in a rusty 55-gallon drum, and this is one of the chores for the 2 oldest. They go down and they schlep that water, 1 bucket at a time. And the dad has a new girlfriend. She's, again, not stable family, so she's already had a baby. And I watched her change the baby's diaper and then bring the baby above over to the drum and take a little cup of water and wash her off back into the drum, because that's how hard it is to get water. And she's not stupid. She knows how dirty and dangerous that water is, but she can almost never boil it with sticks they pick up in the neighborhood. So the net effect of the lifestyle on the two oldest boys, the chronic parasites and the chronic malnutrition, is that they're shorter than their younger brothers and sister. And if you met them, you would know something's wrong. They're not even like street smart. Their brains haven't developed. They're very dull and listless. They haven't been to school since they left Coar, and they probably can't go to school. They probably can't learn now with the way their brains are. This is what is fueling the drug gangs in Latin America, this chronic poverty, this chronic generation of children who have no education and no physical health. So what is the hope of this hopeless situation? It is the four younger ones. They come back to Coar. They are delightful. They are so smart. And they are so cute. But they are wild on Mondays. They got the sugar high. So we bring them off the sugar high, give them medicine if they picked up a parasite, and they go back to school week after week, month after month, year after year. Because that's probably the conclusion I have to give you about Catholic social justice teaching. It is all over the world, one kind of mission or another. There's disaster relief, there's local food pantries, there are schools, there are hospitals. But in a great majority of Latin America in particular, there is this hardest, most expensive, most long-term service of all, which is trying to build healthy children, raise them integrated in their society. We're not scooping them up and adopting them somewhere, because somebody's got to be raising them there. And this is something the Catholic Church can bring to a society like this, because it is big enough and it is organized enough, and there's enough money to support that. So that, thank you very much for allowing me to come and trumpet what I believe is one of our great successes, and just one example of thousands of these kind of organizations around the United States and around the world. Thank you very much.
Will the ushers please come forward? Today's special collection will benefit Rebuild the Churches Fund. This outreach was created in response to the series of fires that destroyed Black churches throughout the South. Some fires were identified as arson, others were not, but all are devastating blows to the heart of the Black community. Churches are not just houses of worship, but centers of ministry in their community. Gathered in our varied beliefs, we give thanks for the blessings of world community as we share our common dream: homes and schools where children thrive, neighborhoods that are safe and clean, a city rich in colors and cultures, an economy where no one is expendable, a beloved community where rich and poor alike have access to the opportunity for a dignified and productive life. Churches, mosques, synagogues, and temples, where our deepest hope is to be of service to a hurting world. Enable us as we leave this place to carry forth this prayer into the coming week, turning our thoughts toward charity, our hearts toward justice, and our hands toward the work of peace.